This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
Kevin Nish is a peace activist from Victoria who was on board a Turkish vessel when it was boarded by Israeli commandos on May 31st. The Mavi Marmara was one of a large flotilla of ships en route to Gaza, loaded with humanitarian aid. Kevin Nish witnessed the violence of the Israeli assault that led to the deaths of 9 Turkish men. He was subsequently detained for many hours on the boat and then spent 2 days in Beersheba prison before being deported from Israel. Kevin Nish was in Vancouver a week ago speaking about his experiences on the Mavi Marmara, and we're going to bring you some excerpts from his talk this morning. He began the evening by explaining why it was that he decided to join the flotilla in the first place, and we join him here as he responds to an accusation printed in the National Post that he is a Chardonnay socialist.
I should give you a rundown of just who I am, because the National Post has called me a Chardonnay socialist, and that means I'm a rich kid from Oak Bay who does things for a thrill. They covered up the fact that my mom was a Marxist feminist, my dad was a communist. I've been active all my life in all sorts of different causes. I started with my mom as a 6-year-old in front of the Bay Store in Victoria. Silent vigils for the against the Vietnam War, and I remember watching people spit at my mom. 89, I was a human shield in Guatemala for Rigoberta Menchu, Nobel Peace Prize winner. I've been an election observer in El Salvador twice. I've been to Colombia a number of times last couple of years for political prisoners, visiting them in prison, and I've been to Palestine as well in 2002. March 2002, when the Israelis reinvaded, and I rode the ambulances as a human shield for the ambulance drivers, and to help pick up bodies in the streets. So it's not just Israel. I've been active in all sorts of causes all my life. So they can't make that mud stick on me that I'm some sort of anti-Semitic whatever. I just hate bullies. I don't care what religion or race they are. As far as being brave or whatever, I wasn't supposed to be on the Mavi Marmara. I was on the Free Gaza ship, the Challenger 2. It's about a 70-foot yacht. My job is going to be pretty simple. I was supposed to stand in a passageway and let the Israelis push me over, and I was supposed to allow the journalist on the upper deck to get the satellite link up fast enough to get the news out. So my job is going to be pretty simple, just sort of like rugby, just stand in the way and not be violent. But what happened was our ship, and the Israelis have bragged about this, they sabotaged our ship, they said. And we lost our steering after leaving Crete. And we went through quite a bit of a storm with no steering, you can imagine. Steering with a double prop, basically. And we took a terrible beating and split a seam in the front of our ship, started to take on water. But luckily we got to the rendezvous point. Our ship wasn't seaworthy, and it was going to go into Cyprus. And we were going to miss the whole thing. And then the Mavi showed up, Mavi Marmara, and the Turkish people, they asked if they would take us on. And they were good enough to stop and open up the side hatch, and they took us all on board. There was about 12 internationalists. And of note, they took us on board, immediately quarantined us on the Mavi, frisked us, searched our bags, and being a mechanic, I had a pocket knife in my bag, and that pocket knife was found and removed, and I guess tossed over the side. There was no weapons allowed on the ship. They were studious in searching everything and frisking us down and explaining the rules of the ship and the nonviolence on the ship. Anyway, so I wasn't supposed to be there. Nobody in Canada knew I was even on that ship when the attack happened. So, I can give you a quick rundown of where I was. I was at the stern of the ship, about 10 feet from the windows at the stern, and then the open deck. And that's where the Israelis first started their assault. They were the first ones to shoot. They lobbed percussion grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, flash grenades over the side onto the back deck within feet of me. And in 1 minute, it just over seconds, it turned into a nightmare on the back deck. And in that nightmare were the aid workers with fire hoses and 10-foot poles trying to push the Israelis away from the ship. And they succeeded. And so then I moved away from the windows with my camera, and I was there. My plan was originally was I was going to sail in with the flotilla and then stay in Gaza as a human shield with the ISM. So I moved to the center stairwell. Deck one, there was no access from outside, and that was where the women were. I think about 50 to 100 women and the one child, 11-month-old child of the chief engineer. And then I was on deck two. And then there was deck three with more accommodation. Then deck four was the bridge deck. And you couldn't get to the bridge from my stairwell, but it was the bridge deck. You had to go out in the open to get there. I didn't go out in the open. I'm here to say I'm alive, so I didn't go out in the open. But so I spent my time in that stairwell. I went up to the fourth deck, and fairly quickly I saw at least two Israeli commandos being brought in. They were, by the time I saw them, they had their weapons, main weapons removed from them, the machine guns and the automatic pistol. And I watched the Turks take everything else off them, their backpacks, their ammo belts. I think they had a knife on their pant leg, I believe. Disarmed them. These young fellows were terrified. Their eyes were as big as saucers. They were yammering and yelling and squirming around. A very large man came up the stairs and tried to lean over and give him a haymaker. He wanted at this man, because by then the Israelis were shooting. By then they were picking people off on the decks. This large Turk tried to reach across and lay one on this fellow. The two Turkish aid workers who had this soldier's feet dropped his feet, turned, pushed this fellow down the stairs, pinned him in the corner, and were yelling at him. I'm guessing, saying, "Don't do that. You don't touch this man." So they were trying to protect the soldiers, which is important because I'm hearing from Netanyahu that this was a setup, that this was jihadists wanting to draw the Israelis in and kill them. They protected the soldier I saw, the one for sure, they protected him from being ripped apart, potentially. And they gave him medical care. And then they took him down to the first deck to protect him from anything out of sight. And then I saw a second soldier come in. He was bloodied on the face and bleeding nose. And they hurried him right down the stairs. I couldn't even keep up. But they rushed him down the stairs. And there's photographs of him being given medical care on deck two, I believe. And then they took him to deck one, where he was out of harm's way. But then immediately after that, the bodies flowed in. You couldn't count them. It was just a stream of bodies being dragged in the doorways into that stairwell and down the stairs. It's a cliche, blood dripping down the stairs. Well, it wasn't a cliche. There was blood dripping down the stairs. It was unbelievable, the amount of carnage. And two bodies with twin double bullet holes in the sides of their heads. They had other wounds on their body, but they had two twin little shots in the side of the head. When I saw it, I thought execution immediately. I never said that until I got word that the Turks had proven it. And then I said it in my first press conference, that I saw execution-style shots to the head from the Israelis. And that might be why, as it happens, canceled my interview. Because as it happens, was going to have me on, and they were all hot to trot. They had the taxi lined up, and I was supposed to turn up next day. And all of a sudden, they phoned up, I think, that afternoon or evening before, and they said, "Oh, no, we're not going to have you on." And that's the end of that. And I think that might be why, because I wasn't playing the good boy, local boy does good story. I was saying things that they were uncomfortable about. Who did they put in my place? An Israeli military reporter from their side. And they put him on a couple of three times. It was aggravating as all get out for me, but...
You're listening to Kevin Nisch, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library last Friday. We're going to rejoin his talk as he describes what happened after the dead and wounded had been taken down to the lower decks of the ship.
So near the end, after the bodies stopped streaming in, I was up at the fourth deck landing, and the door flung open, outward, and a barrel of a gun stuck in, Israeli soldier with a machine gun, and he just let fire. I couldn't see him. He couldn't see us. He just stuck it into a metal bulkheaded stairwell about, I don't know how wide, 20 feet wide by, I'd say, 15, 20 feet the other way, I guess. And he just let go. And the bullets were ricocheting everywhere. I mean, he could have hit his own comrades if they were still there. He would have. And he just let go. And two Turks, one guy had a chain, one guy had a steel bar, and they whipped at the barrel, trying to knock the barrel down and drive this Israeli soldier back out. They managed to drive the barrel, and whoever was holding it back, a big guy reached around, grabbed the door by the broken glass, and slammed it shut. And then he stood on either side of the door with their chains and their bars, ready to do it again. If that guy got in the door with his gun, anybody with a camera was toast, I think, because he shot journalists, I believe, on purpose. But luckily, fairly quickly, the captain came on announcing that the bridge had been seized, that they'd lost the bridge. Israelis controlled the bridge. Basically, they weren't going to Gaza, and that that it was over, basically. And then somebody in English came on and repeated the same thing. I think it might have been the Israeli Knesset member, Hanan. I think it might have been her. And anyways, but the important point of all this is, again, they're saying that that we were a ship of hate, that we were just there to draw the Israelis in and kill them. What I saw was the second they announced that the ship had been taken, the bridge, and that they weren't going to Gaza, it was like somebody flicked a switch. The fellows, or everybody, just simply dropped what they had, they turned and went down the stairs. No word of a lie. It was like a magnetic switch. They simply dropped all the bars and chains, turned and went down the stairs. It's important for me to, because that's what I saw. And it's important because if they were there to kill Israelis and to just kill Jews, they would have carried on fighting. They would have drawn the Israelis into the ship, where bars and chains in close hand-to-hand combat would have hurt Israelis. They would have been fair. They would have taken some Israelis out, you know, fighting from hatch to hatch, room to room, bulkhead to bulkhead. They would have taken people out, you know, because they would have gone right to the bowel of the ship, right to the basement where their comrades were, where the soldiers were held. And then, they would have taken some damage out on the Israelis, but they didn't do that. The second they lost a bridge, the second the skipper said, "We're not going to Gaza," the fight was done. The purpose was done. There was no sense hurting anybody anymore. And they just dropped and went downstairs. And I just followed them down. And we did what we were told. We went down to the lounge and just peacefully sat in the lounge waiting for the Israelis to cuff us and drag us away. So that's what happened when the ship, when the bridge was taken. And for a long time after that, Hanan, I'm pretty sure it was Hanan, but certainly a woman in English. A woman on the PA system repeated over and over and over again, "Stop shooting, Israeli soldiers, stop shooting, we're not resisting anymore." You can hear it on the Al Jazeera footage, repeating over and over again, "Please stop shooting, we've released your comrades unharmed. Stop shooting, there's no more resistance," because we heard machine gun fire for a long time after. I don't know how long, but it was gunfire all over the ship continuously for a long time. And she was begging, basically, "Stop shooting, stop shooting, stop shooting, please, please, please." And it took quite a while, but that's how it wrapped up at the end. That's what I saw and heard.
After the bridge of the ship was seized, Kevin Nisch was taken down to the lounge with the rest of the passengers, and this is what happened when they got down there.
We went to the lounge, and I sat where I was quite close to the back. The Israelis were all through on the back windows, looking in on us with their guns, and quite surreal because there's still some smoke around and tear gas and this and that. And all their laser sights were sort of shining through the smoke. And if anybody got up, you got a bunch of little laser dots on you. And people and the soldiers screaming through the glass, "Sit down, sit down, sit down." And you sat down. And what I did quickly was I destroyed the evidence. I wanted to get rid of any names, because everybody exchanged emails. I got rid of all of that. Tore up all my notes, kind of funny. Tearing things up and this and that, and getting my chip out of my camera, getting my camera away from me, away from my baggage, so they wouldn't link me with a camera, hoping that if they didn't think I had a camera, I might get that chip out. I got it out. You can see some of the pictures and some of the...
Yeah.
quick comical moment was, okay, there, I've torn up my notes, I'll get rid of all the email addresses, all the names, you know, it's all done, there, I'm clean. We went out one by one. After quite a while, the soldiers never did, they wouldn't come in. And Hanin negotiated bravely of her, because she walked right up to them with a sign in Hebrew, explaining what the situation was, I guess, to negotiate to get the wounded out. She wanted to get the wounded out, and she spent quite a while negotiating, and finally they agreed, and they packed the they started packing the wounded out, and the Israelis took the wounded and packed them out, and the helicopters started to come. I don't think the helicopters came in then. They sort of stockpiled the wounded upstairs. Of note, there was a German doctor next to me, and one patient was so serious that they turned and asked, I think it was Hanin, said, is there a doctor here? Is there a doctor here or a nurse that can go with this man? And this German doctor said, it was Matthias. Oh, he said, well, I'm a doctor. No, he said, certainly, I'll go. And he stepped forward and walked over to the doorway to accompany and hold the IV bag and accompany this injured Turk up the stairs or wherever he was from. And I watched it. The Israelis grabbed him and cuffed him behind his back and took him away. I saw that. I couldn't believe it, but I saw it. So his medical career on the MAVI was short. So eventually they got us out, and we paraded up to the door, and they called us up, you know, table by table, and he said, empty your pockets. So I pulled out my, I had 3,000 US, because I had to pay for, you know, many months in Gaza, you know, there's no ATMs there, 3,000 US and $100 bills, and a Ziploc bag laying right out flat there for him to see with my wallets and everything else, and my reading glasses, my passport, and the soldier looked at it, took the wad of money in my wallet, tossed it at his feet, gave me my reading glasses and my passport back. I said, get out of here. Well, my money out. And my guns rolled to my head, and they cuffed me up and up the stairs. And the 3,000 US is gone. Well, there was 4,000 bucks total, euros and Canadian funds. It's so far it's gone. But maybe the wallet's come back. I got a phone call from Turkey that maybe the wallet showed up. But anyway, so they cuffed us up, went upstairs. They kept us on the back deck in the sun for about 3 hours, and sitting on our heels or sitting on our ass, stress position. I didn't understand what a stress position means. Now I know what a stress position means when you're forced to sit in one spot and not move. And then from there we were put into the lounge at the front eventually, and cuffed at the front then, and denied access to a bathroom unless you begged and begged and begged and groveled to them, and I didn't grovel, and they didn't like me for that. So I didn't get access to a bathroom for 15 hours. Groveling, peeing in a corner. And when you can't get up and move, I won't go into the details. But I wouldn't grovel to a little 17-year-old kid with a machine gun. So I'll tell you what happened. Because there's two huge washrooms there, you know, big washrooms, two of them on either side of the lounge. So I said, I need to go to the bathroom. You know, I'm an adult, you know, I haven't done anything. I'm just, you've captured me. I wasn't doing anything. I'm in international waters. You're kidnapping me. Nothing, no acknowledgement. So I tried it again after a few minutes. I need to go to the bathroom, please. Nothing's fine. I think after 15 minutes, again, I need to go to the bathroom, please. I need to go to the bathroom. And the guy strides over, and he grabs the two tie wraps on my wrist and yanks and sucks them up so tight. You can still see the mark on my hand. You know, a plastic tie wrap, you wouldn't think it could make a mark, but it wore through my skin. So I was bleeding. And sucked it up so tight that my hand swelled up and went numb, and I'm still numb there. And that happened three times to me, because I wouldn't grovel and whatever. And it happened to everybody around me. Anybody who looked the wrong way, who stood up to them, who any one of the folks that were with me, they'd walk over and zip. I watched a guy go by me, and his hands were like balloons. But he's stoic. He just walked by me, and he wasn't going to beg to have them loosen these things. A lot of people ended up begging because it got painful. I can tell you, it got painful. But this man would not beg, so he went by with his hands puffed up, purple like balloons, and he just head held high went by me. But anyway, that's the level we're dealing with. I mean, that's what I saw. I mean, commentary. I won't give opinions. That's what I saw. And then, so that was 12 hours getting to Ashdod. So the, you know, the fighting started at 4, wrapped up at 4:30-ish some odd, and you know, and then we ended up 12 hours getting to Ashdod, and then it took 12 more hours to get me off the ship, and that's because I stood up to them a couple of three times. If they were going to lay a beating on an Arab for standing up, I stood up next to the Arab or the Turk, and they wouldn't beat on me because you know they knew who I was. So I think the Turks liked that, but the Israelis were mad at me. So they as punishment, and I didn't mind. They threw me in with the Turks, as opposed to releasing me. All the Westerners were released right away. They were offered beer and food and water on the shoreline, in the dock. They, you know, they're paraded in front of the media. Here's how we treat these internationalists, and yada yada yada. Me, they left, and they did that immediately, 6 in the evening when the ship docked. Me, I didn't get out of the bowels of that ship till 12 or 6 the next morning. And there was exactly 15 Turks behind me, and it was 680 people, I believe, on that ship. So I was one of the last people to leave that ship because they didn't like me. And that's why I got my chip off, because by the time I got off the ship, I had stumbled out of there. I stopped drinking water. When you don't let you pee, you stop drinking water. And that ship was hot. And even the Turks were begging me to drink water, but I wasn't going to drink water because you have to pee. And I wasn't going to beg these assholes to go to the bathroom. So, anyways, and you know, we got candy bars. And we were in there for 24 hours. We got candy bars, for crying out loud, you know, and sugar cookies. It was... Anyway, so yeah, I stumbled off the ship, and they had this fancy bunch of immigration. You know, as if I was coming off a leisure tour ship. You know, these nice tables and clean white outfits and medical people to check us out. And so I stumble up to this table and I hand my passport over, and the immigration guy says, "Canadian." He says, "Why are you here now?" You know, i.e., why wasn't I off the ship 12 hours earlier? I said, "Well, talk to them. Don't blame me." But it was good, because by that point they were sick and tired of body cavity searches, because they did that. If somebody had a camera and the chip wasn't in it, where's the chip? So they searched these people till they found the chips, and they did body cavity searches. They stripped it, you know, a lot of people naked. But when they got to me, they were so sick and tired of that. And by that point, they had only been processing Turks and Arabs. You know, they weren't worried about cameras and these folks. So when I came out, they didn't know what to do with me. They were sick and tired of this stuff, and I acted stupid. I filled out their forms and gave them my medical history. You know, they wanted to know what was wrong with me. I told them honestly, and I think because of that, they thought I was just a naive, dumb cluck Canadian, and they just sort of ushered me. Maybe I am. They ushered me through, and I got through. So the chip. Well, there was a variety of places. I moved it around. Because I didn't want them to get the chip. It was important that either the chip got through or the chip got destroyed. I didn't want them, because compromising photographs, A, of dead and wounded, and B, of people holding the Israeli soldiers as they captured them. So I had, at certain times, I had the chip, you know, between my fingers, small chip, and the plan was, if I was going to lose it, if I could see it was obvious, I'd flip it, or I'd crush it, or I'd do something with it quickly. But it turned out every time I hit it somewhere, they didn't search there. I was lucky. And then we went to Beersheba, and lots of stories. So we arrived at Beersheba. I haven't eaten for God knows how long, a day and a half. I think I hadn't really eaten other than candy bars and sugar cookies. And we arrived at Beersheba, and the guard walks in. Nice new prison, but it had no water, had no electricity in parts of the kitchen. It was, you know, basic, nothing really, and filthy, dirty blankets. I mean, just full of sand and grit and disgusting. And the guard walks in with this big box and just drops it and walks out. And a fellow named Ishmael, a beautiful flowing robes, a British fellow, but Muslim, lovely man. And he strides over in his cap and robe, and he opens the box and he pulls out a frozen loaf of bread. The whole box is full of frozen, rock hard frozen loaves of bread. And he takes out the loaf and he taps it on the side of the box. He says, "Who do these people think we are? Savages?" And he tosses the bread back into the box and walks away. But then we got sliced cucumbers, which ate a little better. But anyways, that's what our first meal was in the prison. I demanded to see my embassy from the second I got into Ashdod. I demanded and demanded and demanded. I want to see my embassy. I want to see a lawyer. I want to see an embassy. I want to see a lawyer, over and over and over again, all the way through the prison system. And 2 days after I was in prison, I hear a voice saying, starting, Kevin, and I get out of my bunk and hear the embassy. My embassy thought I was dead, because all the reports from everybody else, because I was the last cell block they searched. And so when they arrived there, they already had the press release ready for Canada, because they thought I was dead. Because they had heard that I was, and it was true, I was standing on the port side at the front with a woman called Sarah from the States. That's the last time anybody saw me, because I went down to have a sleep. And everybody reported, well, Kevin was here. And then they found out, well, that's where the machine gun opened up. That's where the first murders were, was right there. And they thought I was murdered, pitched over the side. And they had already drafted in their minds the release to Ottawa that Kevin Nash is dead. He was shot at this spot and lost at sea. So when I walked out, I walked out, and the embassy says, "You're Kevin Nash?" Well, yes. Well, you're supposed to be dead. You've ruined our press release. But the point is, the Israelis knew where I was. They had my passport, and they wouldn't tell them. They were at the Ashdod early when the Westerners were released early on. And the Israelis wouldn't say that I was on the ship. They wouldn't say anything. They said, no, there's nobody on the ship. All the Westerners are gone. So the embassy didn't know where I was. And if they'd walked up to the edge of the dock and looked in the window, they could have seen me. I was sitting there sweating. But the Israelis did nothing. They simply I was disappeared. And I was the same. Nobody saw their embassies. Every single embassy had to walk through like these folks did, shouting the names of people. They're shouting, coming in saying, Macedonia, anybody from Macedonia, whatever country, Pakistan or Jordan, anybody from Jordan in here? And the Israelis did nothing. I never did see a lawyer. They demanded that we sign voluntary deportation letter. And I wouldn't sign until I knew everybody on my ship was safe. And the embassy said, don't do that. You'll be in here a long time. So I'm not going until I know everybody on my ship is safe. What helped to change my mind was four people refused to sign those and refused to get on the bus to go to the airport at the end. And they were dragged out, taken to the airport. And when they wouldn't sign the voluntary deportation letter, they were beaten. And you can check it yourself. His name's Ken O'Keefe. He's an ex-U.S. Marine. He's an Irish citizen now. And I saw him in Istanbul after he arrived, and he was blood from head to foot. And he never did sign up, but he was eventually deported like the rest of us.
You're listening to Kevin Nash, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library last Friday. Nash was en route to Gaza on a Turkish vessel when it was boarded by Israeli commandos on May 31st. In this next story, two things come through clearly. First, the depth of his commitment to his role as a human shield, and second, the appreciation of his fellow passengers for what he was able to accomplish on the ship.
A quick story. Can I tell a quick story? Sure. And it's a nice story. We're all sitting. Again, you sit for 3 hours in the sun on your ass and your heels. You get sore, and if you move around, the guns are on you and the clubs are up. They were very threatening, and many soldiers, many guns. And I was sitting there. All of a sudden, two young Arab men right beside me just rose up. And I guess they had just had enough. They just had enough. And they were willing to take a beating or whatever just to show resistance or to stretch. So they just rose up, and like anybody, you rose up and they stretched your legs, and you're all cuffed up behind your backs. And the Israelis started to sort of come from different directions with their guns out, yelling and screaming, and the batons being pulled out of their holders and their belts. And I thought they were going to beat the stink out of these guys. They're going to lay a whooping on these guys. Well, what am I here for? Well, I rose up. I stood up, and I was right next to me, luckily. And so I just rose up beside them. And the guns came down, because they knew who I was. So the guns came down, the batons went down. They didn't lay a hand on us. And these two Arab, I think one was Macedonian, they got stretched out, and once they saw me, that I was beside them, I guess maybe for mercy for me, they sat down then, and I sat down with them. But I kind of flopped down and rolled around. You're cuffed up behind your back, and my legs are just sore. My shoulders are in agony from being pulled back by these cuffs, plastic cuffs, and they were tight. So I rolled around and sort of flopped around like a roly-poly and got straightened out. And there were four women journalists, Turkish Arab women journalists, that were sitting next to me, and their hands weren't cuffed. And And one of them leaned forward to me and said, "Oh, something fell out of your pocket, sir." She poked around in my pocket. I thought, well, whatever. There's nothing in my pocket. The Israelis took everything. My passport and glasses were in my left pocket, zipped up. I didn't take any notice of it. I don't know, who knows what could have fallen out or whatever. And it wasn't until I was moved to the sexes were separated, and I was moved to the lounge for the rest of the trip, about 3 hours up on the deck, and I got my hands cuffed at the front then, and I got around to poking into my pocket. She had poked two U.S. $100 bills into my pocket, rolled up. And I guess it's a thank you for standing up with these other two fellows. And she didn't know it, but I was penniless. So that $200 kept me going all the way through Istanbul and all the way until I got to Victoria. That was the only money I had. So thank you very much for that.
There were many questions for Kevin Nisch from the audience over the course of the evening. We're going to close with his response to a key question in an action where so many people lost their lives. A woman in the audience asked if it was worth it. Here's his response.
I was crying about the men that were killed, murdered. Great things have come from it. The Rafah crossing has been opened. The mask has been taken off of Israel. Nobody would believe a Turk. If it was a Turk standing up here telling you all this, or a Palestinian, you wouldn't be here, honestly. And the media wouldn't care less. But me being a rich kid from Obey, and nobody calls me a liar. Anybody who knows me, they can't make that stick. And I'm certainly not anti-Semitic, because I've done this work all over the world all my life. So it's taken the mask off. It's done great things. But those nine men, I broke down in prison at one point in a corner, and this huge Turk. It looked like Sean Connery. Is this wonderful fellow, but he's huge, powerful. And I'm sort of weeping in the corner, and this big fellow comes over and he hauls this, somebody who could speak English over, and he's, "What's the matter with you? Is someone wrong with Kevin? What's wrong with Kevin?" Sort of thing in Turkish. And I said, "Well, I said, you know, 16 good men died. That's all I could say." And he said, "Oh, no, Kevin." He says, they're doing it for a good cause. They knew what they're doing, they died for a good cause. And he said, hundreds if not thousands will live because these men died. That if it breaks the blockade, it will save hundreds or thousands of lives. And so that's what I heard from the Turks and the Kuwaitis and the Arabs and the Jordanians and Palestinians who were with me. They thought it was worth it. And obviously, once the Israelis started to shoot, they could have just dropped everything and just gone inside. It was simple. The helicopters start shooting at you. Well, that's the end of the game. Let's go inside. They didn't go inside. They stood on the deck. And they took it, and they knew what was coming. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. These nine men. I recognize a few of them here. They're just pot-bellied, reading glasses, balding men. They're no different than me. They were just working class stiffs. If you read in here, they had families and whatnot, and there's common Joes. They weren't jihadists. They weren't athletes of any sort. I saw them laying bleeding in front of me. They were just out of shape older men.
We've been listening to excerpts from a talk by Kevin Nisch. Nisch was on board the Turkish vessel, the Mavi Marmara, where nine people were killed by Israeli commandos. You can hear his whole talk at workingtv.com. And we'd like to thank Julius Fisher and Working TV for permission to broadcast excerpts from this event. And if you would like to check out the whole talk, again, that address is workingtv.com.